Now, a special audio presentation by Garner Ted Armstrong entitled Signs of Tribulation.
Your daily news reports, like mine, are filled with a never-ending series of floods, drought, hurricanes, tornadoes, of famines, wars, terrorism, crime, arson, racism, drug abuse, murder. A horrifying tale of human tragedies, of accounts of man's inhumanity to man, and nature itself seeming to writhe in chaos. Jesus Christ of Nazareth is the greatest prophet who ever lived. About one-third of your Bible is prophecy. And the most famous prophecy in all the Bible is the Olivet Prophecy of Matthew 24, of Mark 13, and Luke 21. Jesus said this, and I quote, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not from the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved." And Moffat adds alive, because that's what it's talking about, "except those days should be cut short, shortened by divine intervention, there would not be a man, woman, or child left alive on the face of the earth." But Christ said, and thank God he did, here is the good news in his prophecy. He said, "But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." God is going to intervene. Just how close are we now to the beginning of the great tribulation prophesied by Jesus Christ? And how will we know? What are the signs of tribulation? I want to talk to you now for the next hour plus, an hour 15 or 20, whatever we can talk for here, whatever length of time that we can put together on this tape that you will be listening to, about the news reports that we receive, about the signs of the times, if you will, about just where we are in the light of Bible prophecy. Let's take it a step at a time, and let's understand at the very outset, I am not Chicken Little. I am not saying wolf, wolf. I am not saying let's all flee to a cave in the rocks. I'm not setting dates. I'm not saying that it's before the end of this century or it's 2001 or 2004. But I am going to cover exactly what Jesus Christ said. His step-by-step series of prophecies, which he said, not the news media, not some wild-eyed religious fanatic, not me or anyone else, but Jesus Christ said, would be the events by which we would know that the great tribulation is upon us and the time of God's divine intervention to stop human wars short of human annihilation. But that intervention would take place. All right, we all know that governments are in upheaval all over the world. We know recently of the terrible troubles between mainland China and Taiwan, that war almost broke out there. The U.S. naval vessels had to go to monitor what the Chinese were doing. Gigantic exercises, firing of missiles, overflights by aircraft, all kinds of ships, in order to try to intimidate Taiwan. We know that governments are in upheaval in North and South Korea, in Saudi Arabia, that there is a great deal of tension growing between Saudi Arabian government and the United States as a result of the bombing of U.S. service personnel. We know that governments are in upheaval in Japan, in Russia, where Yeltsin might die at any time, and where Lebed, who is the equivalent of the KGB in the modern Russian government, who is the chief of security, a general, and with quite a reputation, might eventually take over. In Thailand, in Bosnia, in Northern Ireland, in Liberia, in many other countries, there is anarchy. There are war criminals at large under indictment by the World Court that cannot be found by the United Nations or the United States. The world itself is in upheaval, but we've got to remember that the Bible is a Middle Eastern book. That the Bible looks out at the rest of the world from the vantage point of Jerusalem. That Jesus Christ was crucified just outside the gate on the hill called Golgotha in Jerusalem. That his Olivet prophecy was given, seated on the Mount of Olives, looking across the brook Kidron at the skyline of ancient Jerusalem. And sure enough, now, once again, global attention focuses on Jerusalem and Israel. The narrow victory of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel immediately triggered renewed vicious terrorist attacks in southern Lebanon and Israel, and as well in Saudi Arabia, because that is the spin-off from that victory. Hezbollah guerrillas ambushed an Israeli army patrol, killing 5 young soldiers and injuring 8 others. A man and his wife, recent immigrants to Israel from Russia, were machine gunned to death in their car north of Jerusalem in broad daylight. Major weekly news magazines in the United States and abroad trumpeted warnings that the peace process was dead. Netanyahu's speech before Congress claimed that it's not, that there is still room for the peace process, but he made no bones whatsoever about the four major sticking points that we'll cover in a few more minutes, where he is not going to budge, which are the very major points that are demanded by the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, by all of the surrounding Arabs with all of their huge populations and their missiles and their scuds and their biological and chemical warfare potentials. Weekly news magazines everywhere were saying that the peace process was as good as dead when Benjamin Netanyahu won a narrow victory over Peres. Well, it certainly was a severe setback to the Clinton administration, wasn't it? It would heavily back Shimon Peres. Major Arab summits took place in the immediate aftermath, and the largest terrorist bomb in all of history shattered a U.S. Air Force building in Saudi Arabia, killing 19 young Americans and injuring hundreds more. So are we now in the very beginning stages of the Great Tribulation Jesus prophesied? Or can we say, there have always been wars, there have always been droughts, there have always been famines, there have always been tornadoes and hurricanes and floods and earthquakes, and there have always been wars. It's all cyclical. It just goes on and on. It's the swinging of the pendulum. It has happened before, and it's going to happen again. Has there always been the Ebola virus? Has there always been AIDS? Have nations always possessed nuclear armaments? Has there always been nuclear proliferation? Has there always been a black market trade in nuclear weapons where Western authorities are afraid that bomb-making materials will find their way into the hands of terrorist governments like Iran, Iraq, and some of the other Middle Eastern states that are the avowed enemies of Israel and want to completely annihilate them? Oh, no. No, there have not always been the circumstances in which we live today. There have not always been several different methods by which all of humanity could be absolutely annihilated and exterminated from the face of this earth. One thing is sure, we are living in frightening times. Jesus Christ told his disciples about the complete destruction of the temple and the buildings in Jerusalem. When they came to him privately atop the Mount of Olives, they could look across at the most famous skyline in the world at that time and ask him, "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world?" The Greek word is age, as it should read, meaning the end of civilization as we know it, not the end of the world and not the end of all of mankind, but the end of civilization as we are experiencing it and as they experienced it then. You'll find that in Matthew 24 and verses 1 through 3. A lot of people think Jesus talked about the end of the world. He did not. He specifically promised mankind would not perish from the earth, if you read Matthew 24, 21, and 22, and promised that God would cut short the horrible time of world war and the threat of nuclear annihilation. What he talked about was the end of our civilization. They did not only, however, ask about the destruction of the temple. They asked about the sign of his coming and the end of the age. Now, I'm not going to go in great detail into a major part of that which Jesus warned his disciples would occur first. But just to give you a little bit of history on it, because there's a very great deal of information on a brand new booklet that will shortly be out about the Great Tribulation, is it about to begin? And I am taking a great deal of the material that I researched to write that booklet, which goes 40 single-space typewritten pages, to reveal to you in this taped Bible study right now. Jesus did say, "Look out, because there's going to be religious deception." He said, "Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and shall deceive many." That's Matthew 24 and verse 5. He went on to say, "Many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect." Read Matthew 24:11 and verse 24. Now today we know there are thousands who preach in the name of Jesus, and millions believe their messages and believe they are saved. They think if they only believe on Jesus Christ, if they receive Him, if they accept Him, that He is the Lord, that we have sinned, that He died for our sins, and they call out for forgiveness of sin, it's all over, presto, change-o, they are saved. They believe on Jesus Christ, but millions of people do not believe what He said. You know what is amazing to me? How can you believe on the Lord Jesus Christ as the wonderful Savior that He is? Worship Him, adore Him, pray in His name, and yet not study in great detail His Olivet prophecy. How can you not want to know what He said would be the signs that would lead to His second coming? Because the greatest event that we could imagine, and the greatest good news that any nation could ever hear, is the impending time of God's intervention and the second coming of Jesus Christ to set up His government and to rule this world with a rod of iron and to enforce peace and to bring about an end to pollution and the voracious devouring of non-renewable fossil fuels and resources of this earth, the cutting down of vast timber areas, the overpopulation, the terrible practices of many nations who are in heathen, pagan religions, and where in the so-called undeveloped third world, infant mortality, disease, starvation is a commonplace, everyday way of life for so many millions of people. We ought to believe not only on Jesus Christ, but believe what He said. Believe what He predicted. Now, from the very beginning of the New Testament church, there were false Christs and false prophets. That's been with us from that time to this, and there's certainly plenty of those today. Today, religious confusion reigns. Hundreds of disagreeing denominations and thousands of small independent churches are all over the place and all claim to preach the truth. And yet each disagrees with the other. They can't all be right. And if any one of them is, then all the others are wrong. Churches and religious organizations divide. They split, then they divide again. New churches spring up. And that's true in every religion, from Judaism to Islam, from Buddhism to nominal Christianity, of course. Religion generally is in a Babylon of confusion, and thousands of sincere searchers wonder today, well, where is the true church? And who is doing the work of God? And where is the church today? And where should I go? And what should I support? What should I be a part of? Many wonder if Daniel's prophecy is occurring right now, where he predicted in Daniel 12 and verse 7 that when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be accomplished. And the things he was talking about, if you read Daniel 11, 40 to 45 in the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 7, are the things of the great tribulation, identical to what Jesus said in Matthew 24. And it says, when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people just before those things are to occur. As I look at what is happening to what used to be a pretty cohesive, large, and powerful church of God, I have to wonder. As I look at 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter in verse 3, about a falling away, I have to wonder. The powerful angel was asked by Daniel, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And Daniel told him that at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince that stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even at that same time. Daniel 12:1. Now that's mutually exclusive, isn't it? If Jesus said there shall be a time of great tribulation such as was not from the beginning of the world to that time, no, nor ever indeed shall be, and Daniel says the angel told him there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even at that same time, then they are mutually exclusive, which means that there can't be two such times, that both of these scriptures are talking about the same time. The same time of great tribulation. Now, obviously, because if you look at the fact that Israel is to be downtrodden by 3.5 years, that the times of the Gentiles are 3.5 years, that the ministry of the two witnesses, which will begin only after all organized preaching of the gospel is over and no more allowed, will be for 3.5 years, that Israel will be in captivity for approximately 3.5 years, And there are many Bible prophecies that show that all of those events are going to occur in the same 3.5-year period. Then that means once the Great Tribulation begins and gets underway in earnest, not just signs that maybe it's in the offing, not just signs in global geopolitics, in natural disasters, in the spread of disease, in the growth of war, but all of them together, we can know that once the Great Tribulation gets going, and there are specific events I'm coming to in a little while to tell you two of them, in which Jesus got very specific to tell you exactly what will be the triggering events that will bring it about, we will know that this world is only about 3.5 years away from the second coming of Jesus Christ. We can't know the day and the hour. I'm not saying we can even know the month or the week, but certainly biblical prophecy tells us that there will only be about another 3.5 years after the Great Tribulation begins. Jesus said in Matthew 24:36, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only." And certainly we cannot know the day and the hour. But Jesus went to great lengths to explain to his disciples the general trends and conditions on earth prior to his second coming. He did say, though, that we cannot know the exact time. He tells us, too, in Matthew 24:42, to watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come, and describes how people would be living life normally, oblivious, playing their favorite game of hide-and-go-seek, hide their eyes from the reality and the shocking, horrible things happening around them, and go to seek their own personal pleasure and their entertainment. I know that every now and then people call in to this work, or they write, and they say, "Why, I just found you again. I just found you on television. I used to listen to you or your father on radio back in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s. And they have heard this witness and warning going out all over the world, in South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, all over Southeast Asia. They have heard it in foreign languages, 5 or 6 different languages when we were broadcasting into Russia, in the Russian language over Radio Monte Carlo, broadcasting in Spanish, in German, in French, broadcasting all over the world in English. But you know, only a few over that period of time have truly heeded the message of witness and warning, and only a comparative few have really made the changes necessary in their lives to comply with what Jesus Christ said. Watch you, therefore, and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Only a few have become a vital part of the work of God of this age, and many who once were have drawn back and have decided to sink down into little local independent organizations and not have a part of the work of God. The vast majority of those who have heard in the past over these last decades and are reviewing the telecast or reading our literature or listening to the tapes today take no action. Some ridicule. Some completely reject God's truth. But you know, Peter said people would be sneering and scoffing at those who would warn them of the impending intervention of God in human affairs. He said in 2 Peter 3:3-4, "Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking in their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the Father fell asleep," or the fathers, that means the ancient patriarchs, "all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation." So people argue, I've heard it, I've heard them scoff and sneer and say, "Oh, there have always been droughts, there have always been disease epidemics. Why, people have died in China and Mongolia and over there in Bangladesh and India. There have always been floods, there have always been hurricanes and earthquakes. Why, it's all cyclical. These things kind of come and go." But the Word of God says, "For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the Word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, during the time of Noah, just as Christ said, being overflowed with water, perished. But," he says, "the heavens and the earth which are now, by the same Word," and the Word of God is powerful and it's sure, "are kept in store, reserved unto fire," that's Gehenna fire, "against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, when people least expect it. into which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. 2 Peter 3, 3-10. Willingly ignorant? Does God mean that people just don't want to know? Well, actually, that's true. Christ said the influence of society would be a major factor on people's attitudes. And we know that Satan the devil hates God, he hates God's people, he hates God's work. It follows that he will do anything he can to attack those who are accomplishing God's work. Jesus said the time would come when those who kill his servants would think they do God a service. There is a great deal more in God's word about false Christs and false prophets. There's a great deal in the booklet that I'm going to shortly be finishing. It's not quite printed yet. I have written it, but it's in the process of being published, so don't request it yet. You will receive a letter, or I'll announce it on television when it is ready. But you will read about horrible martyrdoms back in history. You will read a tremendous amount of information in this booklet, 40 single-space typewritten pages that I won't have a chance to give you even on this tape about signs of tribulation. All right, a fundamental truth needs to be understood about Christ's famous Olivet prophecy. And that is simply this, that each of the signs that were to lead up to Christ's return began almost immediately. There were false Christs and wars and rumors of wars and droughts and famines and disease epidemics back then. But Jesus came to two specific prophecies. One is, when you shall see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place where it ought not, then know that the destruction thereof is nigh. And the other being, when you shall see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. And we are in the offing, in those times that are leading up to the developments that will set in place the third temple. I want to hurry along so we can get to that. And also the setting up of the abomination of desolation in that temple, which will trigger the end time great tribulation. Now, of critical importance to every one of us is to keep up with world news, with world affairs. We need to understand what has gone on in our world in the last several decades, even since World War I and thereafter. Because Jesus Christ said there would be wars and rumors of wars, but he tells us, see that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. And we are living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. I don't need to remind anybody about World War I, about World War II, about Korea, about Vietnam, and the agony and the trauma that that was and how deeply it afflicted our nation. I don't need to remind us about Grenada and Panama and the war in the Gulf, nor do I need to remind you about bombs exploding in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, in Israel, and in Northern Ireland, and how the Clinton administration's foreign policy is just about in a shambles because of everything from Bosnia to Northern Ireland to the Middle East. But you need to be watching, and you need to be aware. You must not be like people in this world who just blind their eyes to what is happening and pretend maybe it will go away. Since the end of World War II, during which some 70 million people may have died, there have been more than 65 wars. The wars that I have mentioned, many, many more that we don't even know about, not to mention some of those in Africa, in the Sub-Sahara, in Central and South America. And today, you know that United States troops, some of you may have sons and fathers and uncles over there, garrison hot spots the world over. They are in Bosnia. They are in Korea, in Germany, down in Haiti. They are in Panama. They are in Japan. They are in many other countries where there are United States troops, like in Macedonia, sometimes small numbers in the hundreds of the very few thousands, and sometimes up into the tens of thousands and more. The mere rumor of war, when Saddam Hussein ordered his army to conduct war games near the southern Iraqi border, caused the dislocation of tens of thousands of United States troops, and the ordering of several U.S. carrier attack groups to the Gulf to show you what rumors of wars can do. And the price tag for that would have soared into the hundreds of millions, if not into the billions of dollars, another blow to an already shaky United States economy. The potential for outbreak of violent war exists virtually all over the world. Bosnia could erupt into war and widen into the Balkans at any time, especially in the harsh winter months to come. It could widen into a struggle between Serb-backed Russia and Iranian-supported Muslims. If Turkey became involved, Greece would respond, and the entire Balkans would erupt in war. Now, there are token U.S. troops, as I mentioned, presently garrisoned in Macedonia, and the United States would be dragged in because we've also got U.S. troops under U.N. command in Bosnia itself. There are areas all over the world, and most of the time your news doesn't pay much attention to this, where religion and race, racism, ethnic hatreds, and religion are really behind all the hatred. The Greeks are essentially Greek Orthodox and nominally Christian, and the Turks are Muslims. And for decades and centuries they've been fighting, and it could break out again. A widening war in the Balkans is the last thing the Pentagon or the U.S. government wants. It was a calculated risk to send U.S. troops into Bosnia and advisory groups into Macedonia. Now, massive civil war could erupt in Russia as a result of the death of Yeltsin, if that occurs anytime soon. Millions of Russians remember the good old days under Stalin, and they want to return to total communism and totalitarianism. Of critical importance to the whole world, and of vital importance to any Christian who is truly watching world events as Christ commanded, is what might take place in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf, in Israel, and the surrounding nations, especially of Syria and Egypt, anytime in the near future. Few will know how narrowly the powers involved in the war in the Gulf averted the nuclear destruction of Baghdad in a widening war in which the coalition forces would have disintegrated, and all the Arab nations that were a part of the loose coalition that Bush put together would have turned on Israel. Well, let me tell you something you might not have known. It's been revealed by high-ranking Iraqi officials who defected that Saddam Hussein had chemical warheads fitted to some of his Scuds. Had he unleashed them on Israel, the Israeli Air Force was prepared to drop atomic weapons on Baghdad. They also had biological weapons stockpiled in forward areas, and they were loaded in both Scud warheads and aerial bombs, and the United States bombardment exploded one of those dumps, and there is evidence that the exploded materials went high into the atmosphere and were carried back over U.S. troops, and that thousands upon thousands of Gulf War veterans are suffering from all kinds of symptoms and diseases the doctors cannot even diagnose. One man had internal bleeding that required many, many different operations on his stomach. They still don't know what was the matter. Others have developed all kinds of symptoms that are normally acquainted with things like leukemia and cancer and all kinds of diseases. And there are several government organizations, I should say veterans organizations, that are really angry at the government because it was not until 1996, in about April, that the Pentagon ever even admitted that such an explosion took place so that the public would know that there were chemical and biological agents in those warheads. It's just unbelievable when you look at the times in which we live and what is going on. Well, Jesus said there shall be wars and rumors of wars, and I could go on talking about that for the rest of this Bible study tape. I'm not going to do that, but turn to the next thing that he said, and there shall be famines. Massive famines grip many countries in the so-called Third World. No one can forget the major military effort that cost U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars to alleviate famine in Somalia, and then they couldn't even track down the warlord that was helping to cause a lot of it. As I mentioned earlier, warfare causes famine and starvation because it destroys infrastructure. It brings about massive dislocation of populations, refugees who flee, who have no food or water. And famine and disease are automatically related. War causes famine and disease, and sometimes famines cause wars. Famine can occur from any one of several causes. Drought destroys crops or prevents them from maturing and producing. Floods destroy crops, and prolonged wet weather prevents them from being planted. And that's occurred in the United States in the spring and the early summer of 1996 that prevented planting at the proper time. In Somalia, it was merely distribution. Thousands died of starvation because distribution of emergency food grains never reached the remote areas. There's also simple economic famine. Millions of people in the so-called developing countries are chronically undernourished, which causes low resistance to disease and infant mortality, even though there would be food to feed them if it could be gotten to them, and if they could afford to buy it. The World Press, quoting from the prestigious Guardian in Britain, November 1995, trumpeted in its headline, "Next, wars over water." The facts presented were absolutely shocking. 80 countries are already experiencing water shortages that are threatening health and national economies, and nearly half of the population of the world has no access to clean water or proper sanitation. The demand for water because of exploding populations has been doubling every 21 years. And the water situation across North Africa and the Middle East is precarious currently. Serious drought grips northern China, western and southern India, parts of Pakistan, and South America. Serious drought is gripping a great deal of the United States, from eastern Colorado and New Mexico, right on across into the wheat belt. In some of the most populous cities in the world, water supply is becoming critical. The water table providing water for up to 50 large Chinese cities, all of them up into the multi-millions, drops from 3 to 6 feet each year. Even a cursory investigation of water supplies and management in the world would require several book-length articles for you and I to understand. If you look at waste, mismanagement of water, pollution of water, dumping raw sewage into streams and rivers and bays and estuaries, water disputes involving international borders, increased salinity, disappearance of underground aquifers, all of this plays a part in a mounting global water crisis. The World Bank met in Stockholm, Sweden, and the subject of their meeting was water, was the waste of water and the diminution of water supplies, and they issued some of the most shocking warnings that you and I could ever read. They said the wars of the next century will be over water, and Jesus Christ of Nazareth prophesied there shall be famines and pestilence, disease epidemics. To emphasize their warning, they cited how Egypt now fears appropriation of the waters of the Nile by upstream Sudan and Ethiopia, how both Syria and Iraq are anxious because the Turks are going to construct something like 22 dams along the headwaters of the Euphrates, which is the major water supply for Iraq, how Hungary and Slovakia are arguing about a huge hydroelectric dam proposed on the Danube, which is their common border. The Middle East and Northern Africa are critical in water shortage areas. After Israel diverted much of Jordan's water source, the Jordanian government has said that it's virtually pumped dry its underground reserves, and they're frantic about that. Now, also cited by the World Bank as stark examples of waste were the fact that most city supply systems, you think about old New York, and you think about some of the older cities of the world like London and big cities in Europe, 30 to 56% of the water is leaking and being wasted underground. And most urban sewage all over the world is passing into rivers. It's only here in the United States that at least here and there, there are areas where the water is so-so clean to drink. But that's another subject we could talk about for the next hour, about various local and smaller community water supplies where the water stinks, where it foams, where you can virtually taste it, where if they weren't dumping enough chlorine in it, you would get sick from drinking it. In Jordan, 56% of water put into urban supplies doesn't even reach the customer. And that body, the World Bank, said that the Middle East is the likeliest crucible for future water wars. Isn't that shocking? Once again, it comes back to the Middle East, to Jordan, to Israel, to Egypt, to Turkey, to the nations of the Middle East. The Economist in Britain, its very prestigious weekly magazine, in its issue of August 12, 1995, said, and I quote, "The working assumption seems to be that it, meaning water, is an unlimited public resource, and the result is that few consumers have any incentive to use it sparingly. They warned the time is coming when water must be treated as a valuable resource like oil, not as a free one like air. Within only a few years, America's wheat and corn belt has gone from terrible floods to terrible drought, and sometimes both have been devastating farm and ranch lands at the same time as they are as I speak to you in this radio microphone." That's happening in 1996. Severe drought has gripped the wheat belt, in some places for 3 straight years. Western Kansas, Nebraska, the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles, eastern Colorado experienced early freezes shortly after the 1996 crop was planted, And then along came 50-mile-an-hour winds that caused further damage, uprooting the little tender shoots or burying them, blasting them with sand and dirt. The region had only about one quarter the normal amount of rainfall, and the topsoil is very, very dry. The effect is devastating to farmers. There's a strong demand worldwide for the hard red winter wheat of America's wheat belt. The grain is used, of course, for bread rolls and all-purpose baking flour by millions of people all over the world. And as a result of increased demand and falling crops, the wheat prices have almost doubled. And that, of course, has another effect because now the cattle growers can't afford to buy the grain because with the grass turning brown and brittle, thousands of Americans, farmers and ranchers, especially cattle ranchers, have had to sell their cattle. And, of course, that deeply affects beef prices. So in a domino-like effect, ranchers sell off cattle that are too expensive to raise, and many of them are actually, if they go out there and buy a herd, they're in debt the minute they do because they can't even make back what it costs to buy them. They can tell you that. Stockyards bulge with an oversupply, and beef prices have dropped recently to a 9-year low. The drought is said to be about to drive 10,000 farmers and ranchers in Oklahoma alone into bankruptcy, and the impact upon banks and state and federal governments is obvious. And you know, in a recent ABC television report that I saw, viewers were warned, and I quote this because I remember writing it down and bringing the notes, and I quote, "The Great Plains could turn into sand dunes." On that same program, scientists warned, and I quote again, that vast areas of farmland are vulnerable to becoming desert, end quote, and said, quote, "Dust Bowl days might be on their way back," end quote. One-fifth of the United States was afflicted by the infamous Dust Bowl conditions of the 1930s. And that very recent ABC Peter Jennings report on regular nightly news said that this dry spell may be, and I quote again, "the beginning of a mega drought," end quote. They showed pictures of Falcon Lake in southern Texas, which is 47 feet down, and of the ruins of whole towns like old Padilla down in Tamaulipas, Mexico, in the lake called Vicente Guerrero, which was virtually dry. That old town was abandoned, so the waters of that lake, Vicente Guerrero, could form a huge lake, but the lake is so shrunken that old Padilla that was abandoned is now completely dry. A very good friend of mine, Mr. Jim Thornhill, years ago, I've got a picture of him at home, diving off the top of the cathedral that stood there with only a few feet of its structure above the water, and the report that I saw just the other day was of newsmen with their cameras walking along dry, cracked, dusty street where a few years ago a friend of mine, as I clicked his picture with my camera sitting in my boat in what used to be the main street of old Padilla, was doing a backflip into the waters of Vicente Guerrero. If he were to do it today, he'd go splat on dry cobblestones. Former businesses like fishing docks and marinas were standing there above dry, cracked earth where a beautiful lake once lapped the shore. And Ray Motha of the U.S. Department of Agriculture said, "The drought is one of the worst on record." One official of the New Mexico Farm and Livestock Bureau said, and I quote, "There was more rain during the Dust Bowl than they're getting in Roosevelt County." That county is in the eastern plains of New Mexico, very hard hit by drought. Already, the extremely dry conditions have brought about earlier than usual fires. You've seen them on your national television in New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado. And when a devastating fire raced through northern New Mexico's Carson National Forest recently, an official of the U.S. Forest Service said, "We have kiddingly called the Carson the asbestos forest because it is always so wet and at such a high elevation that it never burns. With the Carson burning and so early, that told us this is going to be a rough summer." Every major weekly news magazine in the United States carried stories about the drought. I saw pictures you wouldn't believe about corn and wheat and cattle prices. Is it only a passing phenomenon? Is it only cyclical? Or will there be more? And will they progressively get worse until eventually the big one will be upon us? There have been droughts before, sure. There have been floods before. There have been forest fires before. But when all the world conditions are added together, when every aspect of Christ's Olivet prophecy is taken as a whole, when we consider the implications of geopolitics and the condition of all nations politically, militarily, economically, and socially, when we look at the food versus population curve, when we look at the exploding populations of third world countries who can least afford it, when we look at nuclear proliferation, at a nuclear black market, when we look at terrorism on the increase and occurring even in the heartland of the United States, when we look at the incredible furor over the Olympics and so much hype over terrorism that one almost expects the terrorists to make the attempt, when you look at all these things put together, when we truly watch world news and observe the entire panorama of events, it is obvious that not all is well with our world, that major events are taking place which could well mean we are on the very brink of the Great Tribulation. The prophecies of Amos might as well be on today's newspaper front pages. He said, and I quote, "And I've also given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities and want of bread in all your places, yet have you not returned unto me, saith the Eternal. And also I have withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city, and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered." So two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. "Yet have you not returned unto me, saith the Eternal. I have smitten you with blasting and mildew." Those are things like root rust and stem rot and nematodes and all kinds of diseases that afflict our grains and corn and wheat and so on. "When your gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees increased," he said, "I've smitten you with blasting and mildew." The palmer worm, a kind of a larva stage of like grasshoppers and every other kinds of insects, devoured them. "Yet have you not returned unto me, saith the Eternal. There are mites that are attacking the honeybees in the United States. Bee growers and beekeepers are in terrible trouble, and a tremendous amount of vegetables will never reach the market. Permanent crops like fruit orchards will simply not be harvested, and some of those are in terrible shape because they say there are not enough bees to pollinate the crops. And the crops, even though they are planted, and even though the little shoots come out with their pollen pods and their little flowers that open up with the sepal and the stamen, and there they are waiting for a bee to pollinate them, no bees. So they don't get pollinated because millions of bees have died as a result of some kind of a parasite that is attacking the honeybees in the United States. Plainly, Almighty God says that he can control the weather, that he can bless those who obey his laws and live according to his word, and he can curse those who do not. Now, the next thing Jesus said was, "There shall be pestilences." He said, and I quote again, "There shall be wars and rumors of wars," that's Matthew 24, 6 and 7, "and there shall be famines and pestilences." Now, pestilence refers to any disease that spreads rapidly, that can become like an epidemic, and causes massive death, like smallpox, yellow fever, or the plague. As was mentioned earlier, warfare often brings the terrible consequences of famine, disease, and starvation. When a nightmarish civil war erupted in Rwanda, and you saw it on your nightly television, terrified refugees fled to bordering Zaire. More than 100,000 died of cholera, resulting directly from the pollution of surface water by human waste. For the better part of 50 years, the developed nations had believed medical science had almost eradicated such disease as typhoid fever, smallpox, cholera, and the plague. But those vanquished killers are making a comeback. I quote to you now from Knight Ritter Tribune News, Robert Boyd writing, threat of disease growing serious, how vanquished killers are making a comeback, and this was written as late as April 1995. He talked about two hit movies. You might have seen them. I don't go to movies, but once every 18 years, I guess. I just don't go to them. But a hit movie was called Outbreak, and there was a best-selling book called The Hot Zone. The cover of Time magazine was entitled Revenge of the Killer Microbes. And it's no wonder people worry about what's going on down there in the invisible worlds of the world of bacteria. Because old ailments that people thought had been vanquished, like whooping cough and tuberculosis, are making a comeback. I have another article right in front of me here that says TB could kill 4 million a year within the decade, and that is a warning by the WHO. That is an absolutely staggering statistic, that tuberculosis, that many people had thought had been completely conquered by modern miracle drugs, could kill 4 million a year in the next decade. Old ailments people used to think had been vanquished, like whooping cough and various flus that killed so many millions in the United States during World War I, the tuberculosis strains are making a comeback, often in virulent new forms, and they are resisting previously successful medicines. Then there are these unknown plagues, like this terrifying Ebola virus that was featured in that movie, the book, The Hot Zone. Hantavirus, that a lot of people haven't even heard about, that broke out in New Mexico in 1993 and spread to 15 states, killed at least 25 people, and drove health officials frantic because they didn't really know what it was. There have been at least 11 lethal outbreaks of emerging, or better said, re-emerging diseases around the world since 1990. An intestinal parasite, Cryptosporidium, made 403,000 people sick in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1993. The largest attack of waterborne illness in U.S. history, and you probably don't remember it. It probably was not that sensational in the press, and very few people paid very much attention if they didn't live in or near Milwaukee. Russia suffered 50,000 deaths last year from diphtheria, a disease that had supposedly been conquered a long time ago. Now, it was back in the spring of 1995 that the National Academy of Sciences met in Washington. And a Nobel Prize-winning biologist, Joshua Lederberg, likened the situation at that time to a race for survival between humans and microbes. The question is, he said, will we get them before the bugs get us? And he said, we're beginning to lose ground. It was in 1969 that then-Surgeon General W.H. Stewart said it was time to, quote, close the book on infectious diseases, end quote. But look where we have come from that time. Now, maladies that used to afflict only the poor tropical countries and countries where there is such squalor and sickness and lack of the right kind of hygiene and where surface water is polluted and people are using water that has been polluted by other people, now those diseases leap across oceans and time zones to come into the United States aboard ship, aboard aircraft, and oftentimes is not illegal immigrants on their rafts and in their boats. It jumps to North America, and it's now affecting Asia on a massive scale. Malaria, for example, which causes 1 million deaths a year, has now returned to both Florida and Southern California. In 1991, cholera traveled across the Pacific and cropped up in the Western Hemisphere for the first time in a century. Within 2 years, at least 900,000 cases had been detected in South America and Central America, and more than 8,000 people died. And recently they've detected cholera bacteria off U.S. shores in the Gulf of Mexico. Lederberg went on to tell that distinguished panel, the microbe that felled one child in a distant continent tomorrow, or rather yesterday, can reach yours, your child, today, and seed a global pandemic tomorrow. A pandemic meaning a global epidemic. Well, here are some of the reasons why it's happening. Population growth has jammed millions of desperately poor people in crowded cities with little or no sanitation. Look at the fact that about 50% of the population of Mexico is jammed together in Mexico City. It's just unbelievable. The same thing is true in India, in China, and so many other countries. It becomes an ideal breeding ground for malaria, yellow fever, cholera, tuberculosis, and all the other diseases. A second major factor, one that you certainly ought to be aware of because of the recent conference in Vancouver, B.C., loose sexual behavior and intravenous drug use have transformed AIDS from an isolated African problem into a worldwide curse. The loss of forests has driven disease-carrying animals and insects into contact with people. The growth of suburbs in wooded areas frequented by deer and ticks spread Lyme disease throughout the northeastern United States. I live in an area where even though every day or two or three is annoying and I've got to put out some bait, which I hate to do, which is laced with some kind of a pesticide to control down here what we call fire ants, we live in an area where you could put a tiny baby, unable to crawl yet, out on a blanket in your backyard, and the baby, a few hours later, could be on its way to the hospital so filled with poison it would die, and it would not recover. A little child seated in the grass in my yard, where I live, where I'm continually having to fight those pests, could literally be killed if bitten by enough hundreds of them because their sting is so virulent. It causes a very painful little yellow pustule to rise up and sometimes takes up to 6 weeks to get rid of the scar. It's a plague. And no one says very much about it. But all of the people where I live know, and in every single garage and on every single shelf in some kind of a cabinet, there are some kinds of poisons and pesticides that are very dangerous to human beings that are put out, sprayed directly on them, put way down where they can try to get the queen, or their baits that they take down to the queen to feed her so it'll kill the queen and the population will move off someplace else. But it is really impossible to control them. Jet age travel whisks germs around the world, and so do changing weather fronts. A ship bearing the cholera virus in its bilge water infected shellfish in Peru. An aircraft ferried a dozen sick people from Lima to the Los Angeles airport. And what is really incredible, and this is happening, I've seen it happen in my own personal case because I had some kind of a respiratory infection that raged up and down through my system for the better part of 4 years. Mr. Charles Gross had a hacking cough and a respiratory ailment that lasted him for over 5 years, and it's not totally over, I don't believe, yet. A neighbor of mine, a lady, I won't mention her name, has had a horrible, croupy-sounding cough for more than 5 solid years. To this day, I will still have a little bit of a dry hacking cough in the early morning when I get up. And, of course, they gave me what all of us take, antibiotics. But finally, those antibiotics just weren't doing the job anymore because whatever those little germs were, they were becoming resistant. You see, bacteria are almost incredibly adaptive to limitless degrees, apparently, and they develop new strains that are resistant to antibiotics. The Muppets puppeteer, I never knew his name, Jim Henson, died back in 1990 of a highly toxic mutant variety of Streptococcus that penicillin could not control. And after 40 years of millions of Americans slathering ourselves with erythromycin, I guess it's called, or erythromycin is the way to pronounce it, erythromycin, and penicillin and other wonder drugs, we have lost much of our natural immunity. For example, the resistance to influenza left by that terrible epidemic that killed about 500,000 Americans, if I said millions, it was 500,000, in 1918 and 19, my mom and dad certainly remembered that and told me about it when I was a boy. But the resistance to that has almost vanished. Blood tests of Americans proves it. Lederberg told that group in Washington, D.C., and that was the National Academy of Sciences that met, "We are more vulnerable today than we were in 1918, and he said, "I can confidently say it is going to happen again." Now, who has not heard about the Ebola virus and AIDS? Public awareness about that pestilence was such that a motion picture starring Dustin Hoffman was made in the mid-90s entitled Outbreak. And then there was this made-for-TV thriller, which I didn't happen to see, called Virus, created by Robin Cook. A documentary that I've also already mentioned was produced about the same time called The Hot Zone, about the Ebola virus, about all the deaths in Zaire. And only a few quotations from that are absolutely chilling. Ebola was unpredictable, it said. An airborne strain of Ebola could emerge and circle around the world in about 6 weeks, like the flu, killing large numbers of people. Ebola is a rather simple virus, as simple as a firestorm. It kills humans with swift efficiency and with a devastating range of effects. Ebola crops up suddenly, and its victims bleed to death in a very few days. It was first identified in Germany, and then later versions of the virus cropped up in the Sudan, then in Zaire, then, shockingly, in Reston, Virginia. In that Hot Zone documentary, it said that the virus, the strain that was identified in Zaire, was not airborne. It traveled in blood, and the bleeding victim did not touch very many other people before dying, so the virus didn't have many chances to jump into a new host. Had people been coughing that virus up into the air like they do in flu, it would have been a very different story. Now, frighteningly, to look at the political and the other aspects of this, when the leaders of that bizarre cult of weirdos in Japan that released deadly sarin and nerve gas in the crowded Tokyo subways were finally arrested, it was revealed they had sent representatives to Zaire to deliberately cultivate the Ebola virus because they wanted to spread it around among world's populations. Would biological warfare be contemplated by demonic human leaders in waging war against others? Well, it has been. It has been in the past. Saddam Hussein has done it. It's already been proven that such methods would be used by hate-filled despots, such as the virulent hatred that motivates some human leaders. They would resort to any means, no matter how cruel, how heartless, in order to destroy any who would oppose them. If you think it is cruel and heartless of those who use defamation and slander and vicious, hateful words to try to annihilate, assassinate, and destroy someone's character, someone's work, someone's job, look at those who will use biological and chemical agents to wreak that kind of havoc and to put that kind of agony and traumatic suffering on human beings. Who can forget the pictures of the little bloated bodies of Kurds, of women, all swollen up, of little children, helpless civilians, against whom Saddam Hussein of Iraq had used mustard gas and they were his own citizens? And such satanic cruelty is beyond the ability of any Christian person to even contemplate. Many, many nations have been working on and have stockpiled and have fitted to their missiles and their aerial bombs biological and chemical weapons. Robert Wright, who wrote an article entitled "Be Very Afraid" in the New Republic, said this, and I quote, "Biological weapons are essentially devoid of international control. Yet they're the scariest of the three." He was mentioning nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. "Not futuristic, genetically engineered genocidal viruses, though these may be along eventually, but plain old first-generation biological weapons are the great unheralded threat to national security in the late 1990s. Like anthrax, that I'll come to in a minute. U.S. intelligence documents released following the war in the Gulf prove that not only did Saddam Hussein possess biological and chemical weapons, but he'd actually deployed them on the battlefield, as I'd mentioned earlier. As early as 1988, our government knew that Iraq was developing biological weapons and knew, listen to this, that Iraq was receiving toxic strains from a company in Rockville, Maryland, with export licenses approved by the U.S. Department of Commerce. Swiss and Italian firms were supplying Iraq with large-scale fermenters needed to grow toxic agents. By the winter of 1990, the Pentagon knew that Iraq had succeeded in packing anthrax and botulinum toxins into aerial bombs. And American commanders were warned. Well, you remember seeing U.S. tanks and troops fitted with those anti-chemical and biological coverings. You remember pictures of soldiers, microphones being stuck up there when they had on these complete suits with their masks and their face plates, and being asked, is it hot in there? And they could only stand it for a matter of a few minutes, and they're being asked to dress in these funny-looking suits to protect themselves against possible biological or chemical attack. When the United Nations began inspecting Iraq after the war, they wanted to know what had happened to 17 tons of biological growth media that Iraq had purchased in 1988 and 1989, but could no longer be accounted for. And they never found it all, folks. They never found it all. 17 tons, and many, many tons of it still are not accounted for. The New Republic reported in its January 29, 1996 issue, the missing 17 tons of media, that means biological cultures, could have grown enough biological agent to, listen, kill every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. Now, I'm not Chicken Little. This is not Wolf Wolf. What are you supposed to do about what you just heard? Well, what can you do? I can do what I'm doing right now, which is talk to you about it into a microphone, which is recording it on tape so that you can listen to it in your home or as you're driving along in your automobile. I can go on television and talk about it, but I can't do anything about it. I can't go over there to Iraq, because I don't have a rod of iron and the power of Jesus Christ to rule this world. I can't go over there and force those brutal, maniacal, filthy, idiotic, I don't have any words for them, despots and cruel, heartless, criminal soldiers to expose where those dumps are and what they've done with those things and find some way to get rid of them. The Iraqis claim that all of that media was destroyed during the Allied bombing, but it's obvious that it was not. Have they really successfully hidden it? Well, that's quite possible. It's a huge country. You know, it's scarcely crying, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, or let's all flee and hide in a cave, or wolf, wolf, to acknowledge the facts that have emerged from captured Iraqi documents, facts related by Iraqi defectors, some of them relatives of Saddam Hussein himself, facts obtained by U.S. intelligence spy satellites, and facts obtained by U.N. specialists on the ground. Now, which nation would be more keenly nervous, disturbed, concerned about such a threat? Well, Israel, naturally, because it was Israel upon which Saddam Hussein unleashed a rain of Scud missiles. And had they contained chemical or biological warheads, the results would have been unimaginable. Not just to Israel. Israel would have suffered who knows how many tens or hundreds of thousands of deaths. Had that occurred, the Israeli Air Force would have dropped nuclear bombs on Baghdad and other Iraqi cities, and we would have been well on our way into a nuclear war, which would have widened into the other Arab states. And it has nothing to do with what you think about who is Israel, whether or not the United States and Britain and the northwestern democracies of Europe are some of the so-called lost 10 tribes. It makes no matter whether you think that, believe it, or reject it. Because you and I both know that the United States of America and Europe and Japan would inevitably be drawn into any kind of a gigantic conflagration of war that was threatening such a vast percent of the world's oil reserves. I remind you, 70% of Japanese oil comes from the Gulf. We're dependent, the United States, about 50% on foreign oil, but a lot of it can come from Venezuela, Nigeria, and other countries, but about 17%, that's an accurate statistic, comes from the Gulf. 46%, an accurate statistic, comes from the Gulf flowing into Europe. Of course they would be involved. Immediately they would be involved. Why do you think we got involved in the Gulf War in the first place? It was all about oil. So World War III, featuring the imagination-defying panoply of weapons, nuclear, chemical, biological, would have spread around the world if those warheads had fallen on Israel and if Israel had retaliated and Israeli Air Force bombers were in the air and loaded with nuclear weapons when George Bush picked up the hotline and began to promise the Israeli government Patriot batteries, and they were hastily shipped over there, and he managed to avert an Israeli response at the last moment. Now, to shift the subject for just a moment, the AIDS epidemic continues to spread, most recently making vast inroads into Asia. In the past 20 years, the virus has infected about 20 million people, most of whom are in Africa, but by the year 2000, it's estimated over 40 million people will have AIDS. That's 4 years away, 3.5 years from now, 40 million. And that is by government authorities, that's by the WHO, that's not by some group of wild-eyed little religious fanatics running around saying, let's flee to a cave in the Middle East. It's talking about World Health Organization's warning of this. There is no American who doesn't recognize that there are political, racial, sociological, and religious consequences to the terrible scourge of AIDS. You're going to be shocked about the next few minutes when I tell you what's going on. And I'm merely going to report it. I wish I didn't have to, but it's true. Do you know that there are so-called Christian ministers standing up in pulpits of many black churches in the United States that are actually alleging and accusing that AIDS has been deliberately spread among the black population by the whites in order to get rid of blacks? That is an absolutely gigantic satanic falsehood. It is not remotely true, but there are many, many people who believe it. I wish I didn't have to tell you that, but it happens to be the truth. It happens to be part of what is going on. I could go on and on about AIDS, but let me just tell you a little more about that briefly before passing on to another part of this subject. The New Republic reported that a survey among African-American churchgoers revealed that more than one-third agreed. More than one-third African-American churchgoers agreed that AIDS was a form of genocide against blacks. Another third weren't sure, and more than a third believed HIV was produced in a germ warfare lab, a theory shared by 40% of black college students that were polled in Washington, D.C. Now, that is patently untrue. It is an absolute gigantic lie, bigger than any lie Hitler ever told, but it's believed. And such irrational feelings fuel racist hatreds. And unfortunately, some of the African-American clergy in their community churches, and they should be the community's natural leaders, are feeding the paranoia. But AIDS is growing more rapidly, you see, among Asians than any other race today, and nobody has suggested that the Caucasian races, like we in the United States, or the so-called white race, has begun practicing genocide through disease against Asians. And yet Asia is where AIDS is growing far more rapidly today than anywhere else. So people need to understand. The World Health Organization in Geneva estimated the number of AIDS cases worldwide has risen by 60% and predicted another continued explosive increase in Asia. Well, that's a sickening fact. It's a sickening statistic to think of how rapidly it's growing and how many people are going to be infected in another 3.5 years. Germ warfare is without a doubt just over the horizon. Such would create a biological holocaust if it were ever unleashed. Both Time magazine and the prestigious British Economist reported in their July 1995 issues that Iraq had admitted to producing large quantities of biological weapons in both 1989 and 1990. Newsweek, only a couple of months later, reported the enormity of Saddam Hussein's plans. Well, I'll go on from that because there's a great deal of that in the booklet that you're going to receive when it is announced and when it is ready. But Time reported in September of 1995, that's not all that long ago, that the Pentagon estimated that just one Scud missile filled with the toxin called botulinum could contaminate 1,430 square miles. And John Donnelly of the Knight Ridder Tribune News noted that, quote, anthrax is so infectious, and they have that, and they've been cultivating it, by the way, and stockpiling it, not only in Iraq, but many other nations, is so infectious and lethal that it's stockpiled by several armies as a biological weapon. An accidental release of anthrax spores from a Soviet research center in 1979 killed hundreds, and the Pentagon has called that perhaps the world's most deadly biological agent. There are those who discount all of this, you know. There are those who say, oh, there have always been these problems. Well, ostriches don't really stick their heads in the sand. That's a myth. But one is reminded of the myth of an ostrich sticking its head in the sand in order to hide its eyes from the horrible reality of maybe an approaching lion. Yes, there have always been diseases, and there have always been droughts and floods and hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes and other natural disasters, and there have always been wars. But have there always been nations working feverishly on stockpiling deadly toxins like anthrax spores and viruses? Have there always been intercontinental ballistic missiles and shorter intermediate-range ballistic missiles and missiles capable of encircling half of the world launched from beneath the sea by a submarine whose location you cannot detect? Have there always been the Chinese silkworms and scuds in the hands of Iraq and Syria and other nations in the Middle East with their virulent hatred toward Israel? Have there always been biological warheads which can be delivered to other nations and enemies hundreds or even thousands of miles distant? No, there haven't. Have there always been enough nuclear weapons stockpiled to annihilate over 20 times the population of Earth? Have there always been stockpiled spores and viruses, biological and chemical agents, which I just read to you a few minutes ago, could kill every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth? No, there have not. Has AIDS always stalked mankind? No, it has not. The AIDS virus was not hiding under rocks in the Garden of Eden. It has come along because of the almost infinite capability of variety and adaptability of microbes, bacteria, and viruses. Now, as mentioned earlier, the prophecies of Jesus Christ strongly indicate that all of these things would begin to come to pass at the same time. That's the point. There's a great deal more I can say about nuclear proliferation, which is shocking and staggering, about the arrest in about 33 different cases in Germany of people who are trying to sell the stuff of nuclear bombs, and some of the Russians who are doing it are claiming that it's something that they've been driven to do because they're in such terrible financial condition as a result of the implosion of the Soviet Union. But Jesus Christ became very, very specific after all these other things that he predicted. And let's get to that in the next few minutes that we have. He said, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place where it ought not, then know that the destruction thereof is nigh." And he said, "Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." Now they were seated on the Mount of Olives when Christ said that. And all they had to do was to turn their heads and they could see the temple in the distance. He didn't say, "Let them which be in Roswell, New Mexico, flee to the San Luis Valley." He didn't say, "Let them which be in Quilcene, Washington, flee to the mountains of the Olympic Peninsula." He didn't say, "Let them which be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, flee to the canyons and the waterways of the Dells." He said, "Let them which be in Judea," and that's the Roman province around Jerusalem, "flee into the mountains." Now, Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains on four sides, on all points of the compass. It's right up in the top of a mountain chain, on the spine of a mountain chain. So which direction would they flee to get to the mountains? Well, northeast, west, or south, or any other partial point of the compass. Take your pick. But they're not going to flee to some dock in New York and be picked up by an ocean liner to get to Europe and fight their way across Europe, fight their way through Turkey and through the Bosporus Dardanelles and all the way down into the Middle East, or fight their way. How are you going to fight your way through Israel to get to an Arab country anyway? Do you know that there are some fanatical people who are still absolutely so mesmerized by the absolute stupid concept that en masse a whole church organization is going to flee somewhere, that they think they're going to go to the Jordanian desert to this day? There are people who still believe that, and Jesus Christ said, "Let them which be in Judea," I'm not in Judea, you're not in Judea, I'd almost guarantee it, unless one of these tapes happens to find its way to Jerusalem. If it does, it means you. If you're not in Judea, it doesn't mean you. "Let them flee into the mountains." Now, Daniel's prophecy spoke about Antiochus Epiphanes, who appears as a type of the coming beast of prophecy, and his prophecy, the one that is spoken of by Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, the abomination of desolation, says this, "An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength." This is in Daniel 11:31. That's in the temple of God. "And shall take away the daily sacrifice," that's which the Levites offered every day in the temple, "and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate." Antiochus Epiphanes occupied Jerusalem. He then sacrificed swine to Jupiter Olympus in a holy of holies, fulfilling in prior type the prophecy of the setting up of the abomination of desolation. An abomination is something that is despicable or abominable in God's sight. Kiddo's Bible Cyclopedia says this, quote, "The abomination of the desolator," which without doubt means the idol or idolatrous apparatus which the desolator of Jerusalem, the one who destroys Jerusalem, should establish in the holy place. This appears to have been a prediction of the pollution of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes, who caused an idolatrous altar to be built on the altar of burnt offerings, whereupon unclean things were offered to Jupiter Olympus, to whom the temple itself was dedicated. Josephus distinctly refers to this as the accomplishment of Daniel's prophecy. Then the Roman standards were also a later fulfillment after the destruction of the temple in 71 AD by Titus. Daniel wrote this, and his prophecy in the 11th chapter is one of the most intricately detailed in all the Bible, the longest single prophecy in the Bible. Toward the end of that chapter, which leads into the prophecy of the Great Tribulation that I mentioned at the beginning of this tape, Daniel wrote, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him," the king of the north, that I believe is the beast, "and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships. And the idea of a whirlwind and chariots can certainly mean aircraft, paratroopers, tanks, ships, all the modern implements of war. And he shall enter into the countries, plural, that's the Middle East, and shall overflow and pass over, that is, going over national borders into many countries in that area. And that does mean Palestine, and also specifically points out Egypt. Now, just as the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 71 AD was a forerunner of the end-time destruction Jesus prophesied, so these events of Daniel 11, which actually depicted, believe it or not, an evil person who was to come in and take over during a time of peace by flatteries, which was Antiochus Epiphanes, but he succeeded a man named Heliodorus, and Heliodorus was a tax collector. And Hitler came along and succeeded the Hohenzollern family, and if you've ever traveled in Europe, you will see the sign Zoll or Zollern, because it means tax or custom, and Hohenzollern was a tax collector. And Hitler came along with his flatteries of a super race and came in a time of comparative peace and took over power, and I believe was like another forerunner of the beast power of the end time. It says in Daniel 11 that the king of the north is to invade Palestine, and that is not Russia, and it's certainly not the United States. It says he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, and I believe that is Turkey, because Edom is Esau, and Moab, probably Iraq, and the chief of the children of Ammon, and Ammon is the capital city of Jordan. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians, it really means Cush and Put, and that can mean that he advances all the way into the Middle East, into Saudi Arabia, because Cush and Put mean India and Ethiopia. And this does not mention Saudi Arabia, which was only a desert area at that time and not an established kingdom as it has been in far later years after the British occupation of the Middle East, and far after, actually, the Treaty of Versailles, and even as late as after World War II. But I do believe it includes the oil-rich areas of the Gulf sheikdoms of Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Dahran and Bahrain, rather, and of course of Kuwait and of Saudi Arabia, where the bulk of the world's oil supplies are. Now, it's not clear just yet who is going to be the king of the south. At this moment in time, with a new government in Israel and an emergency Arab summit meeting just concluded in Cairo, it appears that Hosni Mubarak of Egypt is attempting to emerge as a power broker among Arab nations. Keep your eyes on him and watch to see what happens in Saudi Arabia with U.S. and Saudi relations souring, and in Egypt as Mubarak looms a little larger in stature than he has since the signing of the Camp David Accords. Obviously, the King of the North invades the Middle East, overruns Palestine, sets up his principal place of government in Jerusalem, and also invades Egypt. Yet that prophecy in Daniel 11 seems to strongly state that Turkey, perhaps Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan are not involved. Now, when would these events occur? Daniel's prophecy says, at the time of the end. It is man who divided the Bible into chapters and verses. Daniel 11, 40-45, continues right on to Daniel, the 12th chapter, and says, quote, and at that time, in other words, the time of the invasion of the Middle East by this northern power, the king of the north, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble. That's the great tribulation. I read it to you at the beginning of this tape. Such as never was since there was a nation, even to that very same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered. Thank God for that. Thank God that Jesus Christ said, see that you be not troubled. Thank God that he said, when these things begin to come to pass, then lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. And thank God that he said, for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. It will not be allowed to play out to its absolutely hellish conclusion. The things that I'm talking about, all of which are real, all of which can be statistically demonstrated, are with us today. You could get in a 747 and travel to those countries, and if they would allow you, you could walk to the bunkers and the storage facilities and the chemical plants and the biological plants and the nuclear plants, and you could see with your own eyes the reality of what is facing mankind. But God is going to deliver us. He's going to deliver His people. He's going to protect you, me, our loved ones, our families, if we qualify. There are two kinds of salvation spoken of in Luke 21:36. Watch you therefore and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. If you don't escape them, if someone is killed or martyred, didn't Jesus say that that will happen? Do they lose salvation? No. He said, blessed are those, even if they lose their lives for His sake. But what if they could have the great merciful blessing of being protected, of not having to suffer the anguish and the agony, not only of personal suffering, but the anguish of heart, of seeing your most beloved loved ones, your children and grandchildren, having to suffer from things like anthrax or mustard gas or being burnt in a terrible explosion of some kind or being taken away captive, kicking and screaming by those who would actually just take them as kidnapped victims in warfare. This prophecy says in Daniel 12, at that time, that's the time of the invasion by the Middle East, by this northern power, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble, the great tribulation, such as never was since there was a nation even at that time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Is it a literal book up in heaven? If it is, we all hope and pray, please, dear eternal Creator God, that our names are in it. If it is merely metaphor, we know that God knows our first, our middle, and our last name. And we pray that our names are written in His book of deliverance. Christ spoke of a time of trouble that would be worse than any time in history. Worse than at any time before or since. The time of trouble that is depicted as beginning by two specific events, and that is the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, that I believe, I'm going to cover it very, very quickly in the very few minutes that I have remaining, is as follows. It will be an abominable, blasphemous, idolatrous thing to be set up in the holy place, which probably means the temple in Jerusalem. It could mean a dedicated cornerstone under a pavilion, a temporary structure. But it does mean, I believe specifically, that a great false prophet over a great universal church is going to say that the logical place for his headquarters under the aegis of occupying armies of a multilateral coalition of European forces would be Jerusalem, because that is the hot spot. That is the boil that needs to be lanced. That is the place of collision of the three great monotheistic religions. That is the place where all of the surrounding Arab Islamic states are furious with Israel. That is the place they would like to see destroyed. It is the place they would like to see every Jew driven into the sea or completely annihilated. And it is the logical place where a man who would call himself the Prince of Peace, the Vicar of Christ, or who might even go a step further, as it says in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, and to have power to perform fabulous miracles in the sight of people, to deceive them and to claim that he is God himself. Now, secondly, it says armies will surround Jerusalem. And obviously, either these are the armies that will then be defeated by the King of the North, who will advance into Jerusalem and occupy it, or they are the armies of the King of the North himself that then occupy Jerusalem, this time under the excuse that they are there to protect it, to preserve it, to save the holy places of the earth. Today the famous Dome of the Rock stands on the Temple Mount. Adjacent to it is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we've written extensively about that, and about various Jewish religious organizations who want to build a third temple. I have in my possession a very finely printed, glossy, full-color tabletop book entitled The Odyssey of the Third Temple. On the overleaf, it says this: The Odyssey of the Third Temple emphasizes the central role which the Holy Temple occupies in the life of the Jewish people and all mankind. It also clearly demonstrates how the commandment of God to build the temple is the central theme of Judaism. More than any other previously published work, Odyssey proves that the eternal commandment to build the Holy Temple is alive and well in Jerusalem, waiting to be fulfilled by the Jewish people. And in that book that I have, there are hundreds of illustrations, pictures of every kind of pots and brazen vessels already constructed for temple worship, artist renderings of sacrifices in progress, even a list of suggested donations and costs for various objects. That this is a serious attempt to try to build the temple is strikingly obvious from that very expensive book that costs about $75. It was a gift to me, by the way. On page 104 it says, and I quote, "The Temple Institute of Jerusalem was founded on the principle of action. Its goal is to provide a basis in research, planning, and infrastructure for the third temple. They want to build it. What will bring it about?" All right. Benjamin Netanyahu was elected as Israel's prime minister because he essentially promised four things. One, the future of Jerusalem is not negotiable. He said so before the U.S. Congress. Jerusalem will never again be a divided city. He said so. Two, the Golan Heights will remain in Israeli hands. They're not negotiable. Three, the Jewish settlements will not be abandoned but will be continued. Four, there will never be a separate, sovereign Palestinian state. Yet those are the four main things that all the supporting Arab states and the Palestinians are absolutely demanding take place. So here you have implacability and intractability. A great force in the nation of Israel, because they are armed with nuclear weapons, surrounded by all these Arab nations that want them completely destroyed. Now, what events might cause an outbreak of war in the Middle East? Certainly, with the election of Benjamin Netanyahu and renewed terrorism, and we're going to be seeing a great deal more of it before we have seen the end of it. There could come a war in the Middle East, and this time the Israeli general population might not be spared. If that occurred, you know, regardless as to ideas about prophetic identity, that the United States, if it were able, if we have not imploded in all kinds of chaos and become so economically and militarily weak we can't do anything about it, but the United States and certainly Europe and, believe it or not, Japan would be involved. There are so many specific things that we could go through to see what might bring about a war in the Middle East and what would be the response of other nations. But God does promise His elect that we can be protected and that there would be a way of escape, because He says, "Watch you therefore and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass." And those things are the things of the Great Tribulation. And I believe the signs of the Great Tribulation are all about us. I've asked before, so what are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do about all this? First, we need to know that we're repentant before God, that He's begotten us as His own child. We need to know that we're part of His work. And we need to know that we're among those who Jesus described as those whom, when His Lord shall come, He shall find so doing. We know that God promises every one of us that we won't be tested or tried above that which we were able to bear. Look at 1 Corinthians 10:13. But will make a way of escape for every one of His people. Look at Revelation 3:10. There's not one thing you or I can do about the situation in the Middle East, or about drought, or anthrax, or Ebola, or AIDS, or famine, or plague, or war. We can't influence government. And of course, we as an organization don't attempt to do so, but we can do the work of the watchman. We can be like the courageous sergeant over there on the top of the building in Saudi Arabia who shouted out a warning to his fellows, frantically running along the corridors and banging on doors saying, "There's a bomb." We could urgently, desperately try to save as many as we can. May God inspire you to have a part in His work of witness and warning. his work of proclaiming the blessed, good, happy, joyous, good news of the coming kingdom of God, the government of God, and to give it in place of a suffering, pain-ridden, war-torn, wretched world. Let's never forget to pray as we watch and remember that Jesus Christ said, "Watch you therefore, and pray always, that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man."
You have heard Garner Ted Armstrong.